you will, open your Bibles with me to Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1. Perhaps the oldest book in the Bible. Perhaps one of the more challenging books of the Bible. Because it deals with an age-old problem of human suffering. And it makes us feel uncomfortable to think about God having a conversation with Satan. To think about Satan wreaking havoc in the life of Job. And God allowing it to happen. So we're studying the text. What can we learn from this? What is Job learning? And what are we to take away from it? Consider Job again, as God will ask Satan again, have you considered my servant Job? I want to review quickly Job chapter 1 as we go into chapter 2 this evening. In Job chapter 1, it is God who is singling out Job as a righteous man who is a faithful servant of his. He's asking Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him in all the earth. He's a righteous, blameless, fears God and shuns evil. Satan responds, paraphrased, it's no wonder Job is serving you. You bless him abundantly. You've built a hedge around him. You take that hedge away, take some of those blessings away, and he'll curse you to your face. So God accepts Satan's challenge. The challenge is, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, verse 12 of chapter 1, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Satan thinks that when Job loses his possessions, even his own children, that he will not serve God anymore. Rather, he'll curse God. And so Satan again wreaks havoc in Job's life. In one day, Job loses his cattle and his servants, save one to come tell him the message. He loses his sheep and his servants. And while that servant that was spared is telling Job about that loss, another one comes in and says, you've also lost your camels and the majority of the servants that are taking care of them. But the greatest loss that Job and his wife suffered was the news that their children had died. Satan was likely thinking this disaster is bound to break Job's faith in the loving God and turn him into a bitter, cursing rebel against God. But then we read in Job chapter 1, verse 20, Job's responses to this devastating news. Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head. And he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. You see, instead of cursing God, as Satan said Job would do once these things were taken away from him, Job instead praises God. We know more about what's happening than Job does at this point. Job doesn't know about this conversation in heaven, this challenge that Satan has issued and God has accepted. But despite that, despite not knowing, and yet he will respond to his friend's statements, explanations that he must have done something horribly wrong, Job knows he has done nothing to deserve this kind of punishment. But Job's suffering proves that not all piety is the result of prosperity. Job chapter 2. Consider Job again. As it opens Job chapter 2, it sounds just like Job chapter 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. That should sound very familiar, because that's exactly what the narrator, how he opens the book describing Job. That's how God has described Job to Satan in Job chapter 1. And the message is that Job hasn't changed. There's still no one like him. Despite all the suffering that you've put him through, he's saying to Satan, he's still a blameless and upright man. He fears God. He continues to shun evil. But notice what else God says about Job. And still, he holds fast to his integrity. And this next statement intrigues me. Although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause, without a reason. Even though you've put him through so much, Job is hanging on to his integrity. He's hanging on to his faith. Though you have incited me against him. Incite means to mislead or entice. It means to allure one to a course of action that he would not normally take. Perhaps God is saying, I normally would not allow you to have this much power. But he's accepted Satan's challenge to prove to Satan, there are some who follow me, not just because of the blessings. And Job is one of those. And Job has suffered immensely, terribly. But he did not charge God with sin, nor charge him foolishly. But Satan isn't through. Satan never is through. By the way, in Luke chapter 4, in Luke's account of when Satan tempted Jesus, Luke 4:13 reads, "Now when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him, he departed from Jesus until an opportune time." Satan wasn't through trying to tempt Jesus. Satan's not through with Job. In fact, verses 4 and 5, Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin," probably a proverbial expression. "Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. Stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." Okay, it didn't work that you allowed me to take everything away from Job, but if you allow me to afflict him, cause him to be terribly sick and in danger of losing his life, then he will curse you to your face. That's Satan's challenge again. And the idea, his accusation is based on that same belief that Job is serving you because you're blessing him. You take away his health and he won't serve you anymore. The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." The Lord granted Satan the power to afflict Job, but he also placed this condition, that Job's life would be spared. He limited Satan's power. Again, we learn Satan is not omnipotent. God is omnipotent. And here he limits Satan's power. But here God allows Satan to afflict Job. And look at verse 7 with me. Consider his severe affliction. "Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head." And some have tried to determine the exact disease that Job suffered here. I think that's futile to try to do that. I am going to read to you a description of this affliction, based upon not only what we read here in Job chapter 2, but about what Job says about his affliction. And I'll go ahead and tell you, it's awful. This is from Hartley's commentary on the book of Job. He says, "The exact illness that seized Job is unknown, for boils is a non-technical term. From Job's speeches, some of the symptoms that he suffered included painful pruritus, that is, severe itching of the skin, disfiguration, purulent sores that scab over, crack, and ooze, sores infected with worms, fever with chills, darkening and shriveling of the skin, eyes red and swollen from weeping, diarrhea, sleeplessness and delirium, choking, bad breath, emaciation, and excruciating pain throughout his body. And I know you're saying, gross, David. Why would you share that? Because this is the suffering that Job is going through. Satan has afflicted Job with this severe affliction, and he's thinking, Job, if he's in danger of losing his life, if he's suffering intensely, physically himself, then he won't remain true to God. In fact, Job is so miserable. Verse 8 tells us, it seems to me, something that Job did to try to get some relief from his agony. He took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. It's likely here that Job is depicted as an outcast, that perhaps he's sitting among the ashes at the city dump. And that's led some to believe that his affliction may have been akin to leprosy, and as a leper would be outcast. And perhaps that's what's going on here. And he's sitting in the ashes, but he's scraping those sores, trying to stop the pain. And he's separated from his family. He is in intense agony. In fact, verse 9, I keep that in mind as I read what Job's wife said to him. Job's wife is mentioned only 3 times in the book of Job, and this is the only time we have words from Job's wife. But remember, as she says this to Job, she has suffered along with him. She has suffered the loss of her children and his. She has suffered the loss of all their possessions. She has gone from being the wife of the greatest man in all the East to now one from whom she is separated because of his intense illness. She sees the man that she loves suffering with agony, in pain. I can't help but think what she says to him has a tone of mercy to it. His wife says to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." And I'm wondering if she's thinking, if you go ahead, Job, if you go ahead and curse God, maybe he'll go ahead and take your life immediately instead of prolonging your agony that it appears will end in death anyway. So go ahead and curse God and die. Perhaps she would prefer that he curse God and perhaps God immediately strike him dead than seeing him continue on in this pain that he's experiencing. But here's Job's response again. "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." Again, we know more about what's happening. We know who's behind it. We know about this challenge that Satan has made and God is permitting in Job's case. He doesn't, but he maintains his integrity. He does not sin with his speech. Chapter 2 closes with Job's friends coming to him. And this paragraph introduces us to 3 friends of Job who have a major role in the upcoming dialogues. A series of speeches follow in the book of Job. We know nothing about these 3 friends except from this introduction and what they say in their speeches. But as we read verses 11 through 13, notice some things that Job's friends did for him that I think were good. Verse 11. "Now when Job's 3 friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him." Here are 3 friends that live a distance away. And perhaps it's taken time, likely it has taken time for them to receive the news about what's going on in Job's life. And then they had to have time to communicate with one another in order to plan to come together as three of his friends to try to mourn with him and to comfort him. This they do well. Verse 12. When they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. Each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. Did you notice that? They didn't recognize him. Likely because of what he was suffering. Not just the emotional agony that he had suffered with the loss of his possessions, but even more the loss of his own children. But now he's covered from head to toe, literally, with these boils. He's in agony. They don't recognize him. But when they recognize that it is Job, they weep with him. They, as the customary expressions of grief occurred, they tore their robes, sprinkled dust on their head. They're mourning with Job. They're weeping with him. Romans 12:15 admonishes us, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. And Job's friends do well. And that's exactly what they do with Job. They're hurting along with him. Verse 13. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. They sat with him. How long? 7 days and 7 nights. You do a search through the scriptures, and I think what we'll see here, that was a customary time set aside for mourning. Genesis 50, verse 10, 1 Samuel 31 also referenced that period of time. They just sit with him, silent. They didn't say a word. And perhaps they demonstrated their greatest wisdom when they refrained from speaking. It's when they begin to speak and try to explain to Job why they believe that he's suffering that they became miserable comforters. Perhaps they helped the most when they didn't say a word. They just sat with him and grieved with him. And that's what so many sufferers have said through the years. That oftentimes we don't need to say anything. Our very presence is a great comfort to those who have suffered severe illness or great loss. As we've studied chapters 1 and 2, notice this, that Job responded to his suffering with great faith. He hasn't turned his back on God. He's going to have some questions, some deep questions. He's hurting and he's asking those hard questions of God, and he longs for an audience with God. He wants God to explain what's going on here. But despite the unanswered questions, he maintains his integrity. He clings to his faith. And it causes us to ask ourselves, how will we respond when our world caves in? Will we dare to choose faith as well? But we also learn this, that choosing faith in the midst of suffering will not eliminate the pain. It didn't for Job. It didn't eliminate the pain that he was experiencing. We see him mourning. We see him grieving. We see him tearing his robe, shaving his head, falling to the ground, and even worshiping God. And we see him, even when his physical health is taken away, and scraping himself with his broken pottery to find some relief. He doesn't turn his back on God. He chooses to continue to trust God. And he makes some of the most beautiful statements of faith ever heard. Naked, I came from my mother's womb. Naked, I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. How is it that a man can choose such great faith and still feel such great pain? There was a professor at Harvard University that told the story of the time when his 5-year-old son worked on an art project in his kindergarten class. The art project was made of plaster. It really resembled nothing in particular. You couldn't really tell what it was. But with some paint and sparkle and time in a kiln, it was ready to be wrapped as a gift. His 5-year-old wrapped it himself and was beside himself with excitement. Couldn't wait until he could present his homemade gift, his craft that he made for himself to his dad. It took 3 months to put it all together. Early in December, when the child could hardly contain the secret, the last day of school for Christmas break came, and all the parents arrived for the big Christmas play, and when the students left for home, they were finally allowed to take their ceramic presents home. The professor's son secured his gift and ran toward his parents with that gift in hand, and he tripped. And as he's falling to the ground, his gift goes airborne. And when it lands, everyone could hear the ceramic project break into pieces. And it was perfectly quiet in that room for a moment, because everyone knew what had happened. For a 5-year-old, there had never been a more expensive gift. And he just crumpled down on the floor next to the broken gift and just started crying. Well, both parents rushed to their son. The father was really uncomfortable with the moment. And people were watching, and his son was crying. And he was trying to console the boy. And he just reached down and patted the boy on his head. And he said, "Son, it's okay. It doesn't matter." And when his wife, the mother of the boy, looked at her husband, she said, "Oh, yes, it matters. Oh, yes, it does matter." And she got down on the floor and cradled her son and rocked him back and forth and cried with him. In a few minutes, when the crying ceased, she said to her son, "Let's go home and see what can be made with what's left." And so with the mother's magic and a glue gun, they put together from the broken pieces a multicolored butterfly. Amazingly, the artwork after the tragedy was actually much more beautiful than what it had been in a pre-broken state. And at Christmas, the gift was finally given. And as long as this professor taught at Harvard, he kept the butterfly on his desk. It was a constant reminder that grief is real, that loss hurts, and that from great loss, great beauty can eventually emerge. We're not there yet in our study. Job is not there. He is broken in pieces. He's got desperate questions. He's suffering intensely, but he's choosing to continue to trust God. Can God bring his life back together again? Can God bless and help Job through this time? We'll continue our study, but I want to close with this question. Will you choose to believe even when you don't have all of the answers? That's what Job does. He makes the choice to believe even when he didn't have all of the answers. I'm challenged by this study. I hope that you are. But out of the challenge, I hope our response will be the same as Job's, that we may not understand, but we choose to believe. And we hang on to the hope that God can put the broken pieces together and make something beautiful again. If you're subject to the invitation of Christ tonight, if it's your desire to obey the gospel, if you need the prayers of the church, we invite you to come right now as we stand and sing.